From Star Trek to Star Wars, to the new Ridley Scott film, The Martian, starring Matt Damon, movies and television shows set in space have captivated audiences around planet Earth and asked them to imagine what lies beyond our world. In this hour of midday, what allure does the final frontier hold for filmmakers and audiences? How are films set in space driving innovation in special effects? And does it matter if movies and TV shows get the science right? Midday on Film, Space Explorers in the Movies, after the news from NPR. Spaceships, astronauts, weapons of the future, adventure among the stars. In this month's edition of Midday on Film, we're taking a look at movies set in space and movies about space exploration. From one of the first films to try to get the science of space exploration correct, 1950's Destination Moon, to Stanley Kubrick's seminal sci-fi masterpiece 2001, A Space Odyssey, to the Star Wars franchise and beyond. Filmmakers and moviegoers have been captivated by the possibilities of the final frontier. Dan Roderick's here for the second hour of our show, our Midday on Film, with Christopher Llewellyn Reed, chair of the Department of Film and Video at Stevenson University. Chris, nice to see you again.
Great to be here as always, Dan.
And Linda's not with us this time, Linda DeLibero, but Bill Uren is sitting in. Bill Uren of Goucher College. Bill teaches screenwriting as part of Goucher's Kratz Center for Creative Writing, and he's worked in film adaptation since graduating from UCLA some years ago, and he's currently working on a film that we'll tell you about in this hour of the show. And Bill's been on the show with us before to talk about film adaptations. Nice to see you.
Great Bill. To be back. Thanks for having me.
And what occasions our conversation here is the new Ridley Scott film, The Martian, which is an adaptation, correct?
That is correct. It is an adaptation of Andy Weir's originally self-published novel that became first an internet sensation and then a publishing sensation, as it was picked up by a major publisher, I think Random House, although someone will probably call in and correct me. So Ridley Scott hired the screenwriter Drew Goddard, who's the showrunner of Netflix's Daredevil, to adapt the novel for the screen. And we have what is a fairly faithful adaptation of the novel that'll probably please fans of the book.
It looks good. And you've seen it.
Yeah, both of us have seen it. Yep. It's shot.
What did you think of it? But you want to give a semi-review or mini-review here?
Before the film critic? Oh, dare I?
Yeah, go ahead.
I thought it was very solid. You know what? I went to a press screening, and I thought the press would be jaded, and they were laughing where they were supposed to and upset where they were supposed to be. So it tracked well with what I usually think is a jaded audience.
And Chris?
I thought it was a rollicking good time. It has a lot of the visual iconography of Westerns of yore. It's sort of the entire thing looks like it was set in Monument Valley because that's what the Martian landscape looks like. It's directed by Ridley Scott, whom we'll be talking about at least once again because he directed what I consider one of the greatest space exploration films, Alien.
I'm with you. One of the spookiest ones ever.
Definitely. It's like a space horror movie.
It is. Yeah. What is it about space, then? I think everybody probably has an answer for this. What is it about space that's so appealing to filmmakers, to audiences? What is it? Because there are so many movies like this.
It's the final frontier.
It is. It's a great unknown, right?
It is the great unknown. And so it's a wonderful backdrop for this idea of human striving for what our ingenuity can lead us towards for escape. It's the great other. So it helps us, as science fiction always helps us, sort of examine our own very earthbound issues in this sort of literary estrangement, you know, distance from our own, ostensible distance from our own problems so that we can really discuss them, but in a fantastical way.
And from a filmmaking perspective, I think you get to give an audience something they can't see on their own. So as part of the attraction for an audience, what can I give people that they'll actually leave their house and go see? Oh, especially in this movie, The Martian, the landscape is amazing. You can see all the years of technology building to being able to deliver this great special effect, or it looks, as you say, like Monument Valley. It looks real.
You know what I notice in films of this genre, sort of genres within genres. There's the frontier, there's the spooky frontier, which reminds you of Western films or films about pioneers.
Right.
Right? There's the horror sci-fi space film like Alien. And then there's, well, I don't know how many there are like this, but the Tom Hanks film Apollo 13, another kind of space exploration film that's based on real life.
Right, that's more of a docudrama.
Yeah,
so space exploration isn't a genre unto itself. It's more just an uber genre into which we can you know place all these other more recognizable genres.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That one's great too, Apollo 13, because it's actually one of the few space movies which is about something that took place when it was made in the past. Whereas all the other space movies are about
the
things
future.
That, yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Thank you, Bill Uren. Well, let's start talking about some of these movies, and we'll listen to some clips as we go along here. And, folks, you're welcome to call in, as usual, on Midday on Film, 410-662-8780. If there's a particular film about space exploration in particular that you really like. Okay, Chris. Destination Moon.
Right. So, you know, the first movie about space exploration is far earlier, 1902, Georges Méliès's A Trip to the Moon, but that's a silent picture, so we don't have a clip from it. And, of course, that was inspired by the writings of Jules Verne and H.G. Wells in the 19th century. But it really takes us until 1950 before we start to see Hollywood consistently approach the idea of space exploration. And this is, of course, because in the post-World War II era, we are in the rocket age. And so suddenly traveling beyond the confines of our planet is not so fantastical. And Irving Pichel directed, it was an independent production, so made outside of the studios, a film called Destination Moon in 1950, which won an Oscar for special effects. And though, of course, from our vantage point of 2015, it's incredibly hokey and primitive in its presentation of space travel, it's pretty amazing for 1950. You see people, you know, floating in gravity. This is why it won the special effects award. It has a lot of ridiculous things, but it does feature the first, you know, viably looking spacewalk.
Because some of it was filmed without gravity?
No, some of it but they recreate the lack of gravity in a really quite remarkable way for 1950. And I chose a clip, which is an animated film within the movie by a very authoritative narrator trying to explain to these businessmen who are going to help make the rocket. This authoritative voice is speaking to Woody Woodpecker and explaining the animated character Woody Woodpecker how space travel works.
At the start, the jets blast powerfully enough to counteract the gravitational pull of the Earth. Once out of the Earth's atmosphere, the rocket just keeps on going, encountering no resistance to slow it up. The rocket does not appear to be traveling, but the high speed, or escape velocity as we call it, is about 7 miles a second. It keeps falling in outer space in the direction in which it was started. Now, as it nears the moon, that planet's gravitational field begins to pull it toward it. Can't hear you, Woody. No air, remember. Turn on your aerial.
Hey, no brakes on this thing. I'm gonna crash. How do I land?
Very simple. Just reverse the takeoff.
Yeah, but what about the wings?
Can't use them. The moon has no air.
Now he tells me.
You know, I know I saw that movie on the couch when I was a kid on some Saturday afternoon on television years ago. And it was in color, too, wasn't it?
It was in color. Yeah. And, you know, as silly as that animated film is, the science within it is not silly. I mean, he's telling the mainstream audience about the fact that there's no air on the moon, about how a rocket might conceivably work.
Yeah. It is one of the challenges of making a movie like this. You have to find a way to educate your audience about the stakes. You know, what are all the different rules in space and so forth, so you can understand the conflict. And you got to do it in a way that doesn't feel like school.
Mm-hmm.
So you hear like the happy music kind of underneath that, and then putting Woody Woodpecker in to kind of make it, you know, combine it so it's not like classroom.
Boy, oh boy. Destination Moon from 1950. Let's move up 6 years to Forbidden Planet. Oh, I like this one.
Yes, and this is really a seminal sci-fi film. Yeah. And it was incredibly influential. You can see traces of its influence in the 1960s TV show Lost in Space, right? The same robot basically travels from the movie to the TV show. And then the incredibly important television series after Lost in Space is Star Trek in 1966, and borrows heavily from both the visuals of Forbidden Planet and also the ethics of space travel as articulated in Forbidden Planet. And of course, it stars Leslie Nielsen, who became such a major star in the late 70s, early 80s, yeah, in Airplane and Naked Gun. But here,
this is before he was funny.
This is him as the space captain, right? Sort of creating a role that William Shatner would then make his own very much, you know, 10 years later. And this is also a clip from the opening of the film, again with an authoritative voiceover, because it seems like an easy trick to sort of have exposition that tells us what's going on. But then we will hear Leslie Nielsen. It sort of segues quickly from an explanation of the sci-fi into these guys on a spaceship, which is also the first time human beings were represented as traveling in a flying saucer. Until 1956, flying saucers were exclusively
for
the domain
aliens.
Of aliens. Yeah. But in this film, it's the vehicle that the humans travel in.
In the final decade of the 21st century, men and women in rocket ships landed on the moon. By 2200 AD, they had reached the other planets of our solar system. Almost at once, there followed the discovery of Kuiper Drive, through which the speed of light was first attained and later greatly surpassed. And so at last, mankind began the conquest and colonization of deep space. United Planets cruiser C-57D, now more than a year out from Earth base on a special mission to the planetary system of the great main sequence star, Altair.
When do we get a DC fix, Jerry?
Half a minute, Skipper.
Ship on course, sir. We'll reach DC point at 1701. That's less than 3 minutes now.
All right. Take it away.
Aye, aye, sir.
Chief, we'll drop back below light speed in about 3 minutes. Got your breakable gear stowed?
Aye, aye, sir.
All right, good.
Oh, don't you love all that jargon? That is Star Trek, isn't it?
Yeah, you can hear the influence.
Can I just say something? That robot from this film is that glass cone head robot
with the rubber arms,
stubby arms.
Yeah.
Warning.
Warning is what was lost in space, but they borrow that directly from the movie. Yeah,
I think when I was a kid, I had a robot toy like that a long time ago. So that's from 1956. By the way, what do you make of that music? What's going on with the music in there? It's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah, so it sounds like a theremin is being played in the background, and it's.
I knew you would know what it was called, Bill.
It's kind of trying to prepare the audience for something unusual, to make the unusual usual, so they can segue from what they're doing at home and going to the theater to getting comfortable with everything is going to be different, and then you can evaluate the conflict that way. You know, get all the rules straight, get comfortable.
You know, all the exposition that we've just heard in the last two clips, right?
Yeah.
You don't get that in modern films. You get it in dialogue, though, right? In dialogue, there's exposition, but it's done discreetly as dialogue, as realistic dialogue.
It is. I think this is a product of it's so new at the time.
Yeah.
And you have to make it. It's almost like a newsreel that brings you into the movie to give you, well, this is the future, but in the future we're doing all these things. And it's so powerful and everything is so advanced. We're going to make it sound very mundane so that you can understand this is how everything is going then, you know?
And in fact, the pilot episode of Lost in Space begins with a similarly authoritative voiceover to explain how this modern Swiss Family Robinson is going off into space. Exact same technique.
Hmm. And that's what, 1965 or something?
1965-ish, yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Let's take a call quickly, gentlemen. Justin in Jacksonville, welcome to Midday on Film.
I love the fact that you guys are talking about this movie. My dad saw this in the theater as a child, and then it was one of my favorites growing up. But when I was 6 years old in 1977, they played this at the after-school movie at Dasher Green Elementary. And I'm sure they wouldn't play this in an elementary school movie nowadays, but what a great movie. And I probably watch it at least once a year. I own it. It's a fantastic movie.
Oh, I think this is a rainy weekend. Maybe we got to pull out Forbidden Planet. Thank you, Justin. Let's go move up a few years, gentlemen. 12 years, in fact, to 2001, A Space Odyssey. Not surprised to see this on your list. I'm curious what clip you pulled for this, Chris.
Well, I pulled a a clip that has some of the similar elements we've heard in the other two, because this film also has to deal with how to explain to the audience the science of space travel. And this film came out 2 years after Star Trek, right? So Star Trek, the TV show, has by now made, you know, space travel a little more accessible. Lost in Space as well. Neither humongous hits, but present enough that, you know, it's starting to become more common to see moving image media deal with space travel. And, of course, 2001 doesn't start as a space travel movie. It starts in our prehistoric past and then quickly leaps forward in that famous flash-forward cut of the bone turning into the satellite. But at this point, we are in the spaceship traveling to Jupiter, and the astronauts are communicating to Earth, but with a delay, something that's part of the new movie, The Martian, as well, the time delay that's unavoidable. And in the sequence, we're hearing newscasters on Earth sort of replay the conversation they've had with the astronauts.
The crew of Discovery 1 consists of five men and one of the latest generation of the HAL 9000 computers. Three of the five men were put aboard asleep, or to be more precise, in a state of hibernation. They were Dr. Charles Hunter, Dr. Jack Kimball, and Dr. Victor Kaminsky. We spoke with Mission Commander Dr. David Bowman and his deputy, Dr. Frank Poole. Well, good afternoon, gentlemen. How's everything going?
Marvelous. We have no complaints.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that, and I'm sure that the entire world would join me in wishing you a safe and successful voyage.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Although hibernation has been used on previous space efforts, this is the first time that men have been put into hibernation before departure. Why was this done?
Well, this was done in order to achieve the maximum conservation of our life support capabilities, basically food and air.
So I wanted to play that clip because cryogenic sleep, right, hibernation, is such an integral part of so many science fiction movies.
Yeah, that's true.
And this is not the first time it makes an appearance in moving image media. Lost in Space used it as well. Mm-hmm. And you really couldn't have space travel given the vast distances without that being part of it. And it turns out that NASA is considering that for their long-distance voyages. I don't know how far advanced, I don't know how it would work, but it's not completely the realm of science fiction.
Yeah, at the same time in our, you know, the actual space race is going on and you have the Mercury astronaut program happening and we're moving toward Apollo. And so the tone of a lot of this is very earnest. And the astronauts, you know, the idea of everybody watching and the whole kind of country or the whole planet watching comes back into The Martian. It's a very important part of it as well. Also in this one, there's the conflict with the computer.
Yes, Hal.
Hal. And Hal has actually a very playful, more human voice than the humans, which is a Kubrick touch.
He does. It's a nice touch, the Hal touch. Daisy.
Let me ask you a question. The attempt to me in 2001 was to make this look like a workmanlike spaceship, as close to a vision of what a real spaceship traveling to Jupiter could be, and the work that has to go on board. And that's what impressed me about it way back then. Do you think people watching Forbidden Planet in the 50s had the same impression, or did they snicker at it?
Right. I would have – I mean, it did fairly well. It was a big-budget film for its time, 1956, and there really wasn't a whole lot to compare it to. By 1968, there is more moving image media to compare 2001 A Space Odyssey to. But it's interesting that you talk about the workman-like aspect of the ship because it's still gleaming and very clean. Mm-hmm. But starting in the 1970s, we start to get visions of space travel, which make it look – it posits a future where space travel is so ordinary that a lot of the spaceships are treated by the pilots like our used car, right?
Yeah.
You kick it to make it work.
Yep. Star Wars.
They're dirty.
Yeah.
You know, people complain about leaks, and you don't see that
really.
You got
a diesel leak back there.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Before that space voyage seemed so fantastical and dangerous that people didn't dare sort of envision that.
Yeah, it was the one rocket that went up that in that 5-year period, and it was everything on it was brand new. And as you say, later as we get going, space travel becomes more routine. and it becomes more routine in film, you know, when you have Harrison Ford trying to fix the Millennium Falcon and, you know, with some tape and everything.
An Alien, you get a dose of that in Alien, too. We'll take a break here. We're talking about films of space and space travel and exploration with Christopher Llewellyn Reed and Bill Uren. Chris from, of course, Stevenson University. Bill, who teaches screenwriting at Goucher College. 410-662-8780 if you'd like to share some comments with us about some of your favorite, not just science fiction films, but specifically, oh, this is from the TV show, isn't it? This is a TV show, Star Trek, right?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, we'll take a little break. Listen to this music, and we'll be back. Where are we, Chris? We're traveling through space somewhere.
That's right. That's the music used in both the title and end credits of the original Star Trek television series, written by Alexander Courage. Of course, that original television show was developed by Gene Roddenberry, ran for 3 years, and of such seminal importance in the history of moving image media representations of space travel.
And people still love it, the reruns of the original Shatner series.
And, of course, it's had a life, you know, beyond. We were just talking about Next Generation.
Right.
There are others, too, Star Trek Voyager, Deep Space Nine, all the movies.
Yeah,
the reboot movies, right? There was, like, them it's back at Starfleet Academy.
Yeah, I've lost track of all of that.
It's a lot.
We are going to talk about Star. Do you want to go to the Star Trek clip then, 1982? We'll come back to Alien in a minute. We went step out of chronology here for a moment. There's a. This is Wrath of Khan. This is with Ricardo Montalban.
Yes. So this is considered to be probably by most Star Trek fans the best of the Star Trek films, following 1979's very ill-received Star Trek: The Motion Picture, directed by Robert Wise, who was normally such a good director. But they came back 3 years later because the first film still made some money. Was Star Trek II: Wrath of Khan, in which Kirk and Spock and McCoy and Scotty and Uhura face off against an old nemesis from the TV show, Khan, whom they had left on a planet. And he comes
interesting
back.
Casting.
Interesting casting.
Ricardo Montalban.
Well, you've got two
from Fantasy Island.
You have two hams facing off against each other, William Shatner and Ricardo Montalban. It's perfect. It's perfect.
That's true.
The clip that we chose is not about that per se. It's more about the ethos of the Star Trek universe. It's a dialogue between Spock and Kirk. Spock played by Leonard Nimoy, Kirk by William Shatner. And it really gets at the heart of what made and still makes today the Star Trek universe special to so many people.
You take the ship.
Jim, you proceed from a false assumption. I'm a Vulcan. I have no ego to bruise.
You're about to remind me that logic alone dictates your action?
I would not remind you of that which you know so well. If I may be so bold, it was a mistake for you to accept promotion. Commanding a starship is your first best destiny. Anything else is a waste of material.
I would not presume to debate you.
That is wise. In any case, were I to invoke logic, logic clearly dictates that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
Or the one.
You're my superior officer. You are also my friend. I have been and always shall be yours.
I always enjoyed hearing that kind of. I'm glad you picked that. The altruism, the ideals expressed by the characters, why they're on these missions, the diversity of the cast, the sort of United Nations in space, right?
Yeah.
We're all in this together. Right?
Yeah, and that conflict, the philosophical conflict of when do the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, or how do you make that decision, it comes up a lot in, you know, other space exploration films. It definitely comes up in The Martian. So it's still kind of a running, long-lasting thematic issue.
How did this film come to be, Wrath of Khan? Do you know the background of these stories? Because it's really interesting. Are the same people involved in with Roddenberry in the creation of the TV series involved in the films?
Yes and no. Roddenberry was never really involved in the production of the films in the same way he had been in the TV series. So he owned the rights, and I don't know entirely the history of what happened to his ownership of the rights. But Paramount is the studio that made that owned the rights to Star Trek and made the first Star Trek film. And it was, you know, a critical flop to some degree, and certainly not a box office success. But the fan base of Star Trek had grown over the years because it was in syndication. And that's what had motivated the first film. And it made enough of a profit, however minimal, that you know, they got their screenwriters together and the cast was game. Mm-hmm. And they produced a film that was quite successful. And then that, of course, launched the rest of the Star Trek films. And actually, my personal favorite of all the Star Trek films is number 4, The Voyage Home with the whales.
Oh, the whales. That is a good one, yeah.
But Wrath of Khan is, and the whales one, it gets very much at the heart of if the needs of the few sometimes outweigh the needs of the many, and mm-hmm. as does Star Trek III, The Search for Spock.
And that one has some good humor in it, too.
It does.
Yeah, and then the question of, well, what happens if the few, who you would normally say, you know, their needs are not going to win over, if the few are on TV and everyone's watching them, then what do you do? You know, it's not an easier decision when the whole country's watching, you know.
I see what you mean.
Yeah.
Let's step back to Alien. That's from 1979, Sigourney Weaver. I really like this movie a lot. I watch that every chance I get.
Yeah. Yes, I'm a huge fan of this film. It has the tagline, "In space, no one can hear you scream."
Yeah, right? Is that
so it's big really tone shift. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a great mishmash of genres, as we said. It's a horror movie set in space.
Is that okay? So is that what makes it jump out? Is it because
you know
of
what
that?
It breaks also the kind of code we've been seeing in the other space travel movies, where the crew is very earnest. They're much more like the Puritan kind of Mercury astronaut guys. You know, the best people are the ones who are in space. That's what we've been seeing. And Alien is not that. It's kind of the opposite in some ways.
Right. Oh, yeah. It's a bunch of working class stiffs angry because they're not getting their profit margin that the company swore they would. You've got Harry Dean Stanton arguing with Yaphet Kotto on his side with Tom Skerritt, the captain, about how they're not making the money they want to, while the ship's, you know, rattling and leaking everywhere. Mm-hmm. And eventually Sigourney Weaver, in a star-making role, you know, rises to the occasion. And interestingly enough, Ridley Scott had originally intended the other woman in the film, the Veronica Cartwright, for the Sigourney Weaver role, and then switched them. And you know, I love Veronica
Good
Cartwright,
move.
But I think Sigourney Weaver is really fantastic.
Is this the original one, the one that Paul Reiser's in?
No, that's Aliens, the James Cameron sequel.
Okay, yeah, where he plays the corporate interest.
Oh, yeah he's a sleaze. You want to see him get it good.
Yes, you do.
But this is the second one.
That's right.
Okay, so this is Ridley Scott, you know, coming out of his... He hadn't made very many movies up till now. This is before Blade Runner. He has such a fantastic sense of visuals and working with the production designer, costume designer, the alien designer to create the look of the film that, you know, then has stayed with the series ever since. And in the clip we chose, this is very much about what Bill was saying. The various crew members, Harry Dean Stanton, Yaphet Kotto, Tom Skerritt, Veronica Cartwright, and Ian Holm. Arguing about why Mother, which is the name of the onboard computer, has awoken them from their cryogenic sleep. No one really knows why.
Seems she has intercepted a transmission of unknown origin. She got us up to check it out.
A transmission? Out here?
Yeah.
What kind of a transmission?
Acoustical beacon that repeats at intervals of 12 seconds.
SOS?
I don't know.
Human?
Unknown.
So what? We are obligated under Section
8. I hate to bring this up, but this is a commercial ship, not a rescue ship.
Right.
And it's not my contract to do this kind of duty. And what about the money? If you want to give me some money to do, I'd be happy to, you know, watch. Let's go with the bonus situation. We have never
Can I say something?
Let's talk about the bonus situation.
There is a clause in the contract which specifically states any systematized transmission indicating a possible intelligent origin must be investigated.
I don't want to hear it.
We don't know that's intelligent.
I want to go home and party.
Parker, will you just listen to the man?
On penalty of total forfeiture of shares.
It's all about the money. It's all about the money.
Yeah, it is. You know what else I want to say about that? The set design in this film. We ultimately see what the monster looks like, right? And it's a lot of dark ribs and bones. It's just a horrible, horrible monster, right?
Yeah.
But there are times in this film and in the sequels when the walls, the ceilings, the atmosphere feels like it's everywhere, right? It's that the this sort of the skeletal look of this awful monster is hovering above them at all times, even though that's might be pipe work or duct work around
yeah.
them. Right?
All of a sudden the duct work and other familiar things
yeah.
like pipes and
yeah.
they become scary.
It's really chilling.
Yeah.
Well, and that's why Ridley Scott is such a great visualist. I mean, look what he did in that film, and Minotto was showing us that much. And of course, the design is, and I forget if it's R.H. or H.R. Geiger, the Swiss designer of the alien monster is really responsible because he came up with that original monster design that then motivated all the other choices that Ridley Scott made.
Nigel in Baltimore is calling us about Gravity, which is on our list to discuss today. Film with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney from a couple years ago. Hello, Nigel.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks for all the wonderful shows on movies and current events.
Oh, you're welcome.
The comment is I was at the Beltway 6 Cinema to see that Gravity 3D, and there's that scene where the Russian spaceship breaks apart and the debris is just flying through like off the screen. An older gentleman in front of me was standing up on the wall, side the wall, looking away from the screen as if he were disoriented and was about lost in space, but I just enjoyed that. Question I have is 3D space movies, how many are there? Are any real effective ones and besides Gravity 3D? And thanks for your look forward to your answer.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye.
So The Martian is in 3D, and we both saw The Martian and thought it was great to see the landscape in 3D. It really brings out kind of everything that Hollywood has been building all to this, with all the technological advances and special effects. But then beforehand, we were kind of talking about 3D and space movies in general, and Chris had some good observations about, well, what should be, does a movie need to be in 3D?
Yeah, I don't think The Martian needs to be in 3D, but I don't think it hurts the format. And some of those wide Monument Valley-like vistas are certainly lent a certain majesty by the format. But there are other films that I think did benefit very much from 3D, and Avatar, which certainly has only the introductory elements in space, but is a movie in the larger sense that's about space travel and colonization,
mm-hmm.
was obviously using that 3D format in a very effective way.
Want to talk about Gravity here since Nigel brought it up?
Yeah, it has a great, that moment of the needs of the many versus the needs of the few. In the clip we're going to listen to, there's the horrible moment where Sandra Bullock's character is trying to get her mission completed, and she's delaying them getting out of some disaster coming. And similar to in Interstellar with Anne Hathaway's character, the desire to get this data somehow overwhelms the logic of let's save the crew.
Yeah.
And
because there's all this debris in space that's hitting your spaceship now, and
yeah.
you're going to die if it hits you. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Right. In Sandra Bullock's character's defense, the debris hasn't arrived yet, so she's unaware of just how serious the matter is.
Right.
But this is a clip from that opening sequence.
Explorer, this is Houston.
Go ahead, Houston.
Mission abort. Repeat. Mission abort. Initiate emergency disconnect from Hubble. Begin reentry procedure. ISS, initiate emergency evacuation.
Copy all Houston end in work. Matt, immediate return to Explorer. Repeat, immediate return to Explorer.
Copy, Explorer. Prep airlock.
Airlock engaged, ready to receive.
Houston, elaborate.
Debris from the missile strike has caused a chain reaction, hitting other satellites and creating new debris. Traveling faster than a high-speed bullet up towards your altitude. Now copy.
Copy all. Put a bow on it, Dr. Stone.
I can't. The board is still initializing.
I'm not going to ask you again.
1 second.
Not 1 second, now. Shut it down. That's an order.
Okay, I'm sorry. Sorry, I'm done. Kowalski, initiate emergency disconnect from the Hubble.
All right, Sharif, let's do this.
Roger, Matt. Houston, update?
Well, we have a full-on chain reaction.
Chris, I remember you and Linda reviewing this film a couple of years ago, but I don't remember what you said about it.
I thought it was an amazingly visceral cinematic experience until people opened their mouths to tell us about their backstory.
I do remember you. Yeah. I do remember you saying that.
But,
yeah, I agree with you.
But
opening scene. This is the opening 25 minutes. It's just amazing.
And even the ending is just amazing.
It
but
is.
In between, when Sandra Bullock and George Clooney are drifting from through space, and we learn about Sandra Bullock's past, it's just not that interesting.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate that they hadn't included it. One quick note about that clip. I always think it's so clever that Alfonso Cuarón, the director, included Ed Harris, as the voice of Mission
Command. Is that
because
who that is?
He plays that role in Apollo 13.
Right.
Yeah, and he's John Glenn in The Right Stuff.
That's the Right Stuff.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
he's, that's Ed Harris.
He's the guy you want in space in your space movie.
That's right.
Wow. Also, the music is a major character in that film, in those scenes there, in that opening 20 minutes of Gravity. Let's step back to Apollo 13 then. Failure is not an option, gentlemen, right?
Yeah, failure is not an option. One of the things about Apollo 13, as I pointed out before, it's a space movie that takes place in the past from the, you know, when it's made. But it also prepares us. It's one of the links in the chain that gets us to the Martian, this idea of everyone watching this disaster unfold live on, you know, mainstream media.
Mm-hmm.
One of the great things about Apollo 13 is they filmed the anti-gravity sequences by actually taking the actors up in a plane, you know, shooting it straight up and then, you know, kind of doing that sort of parabolic curve. And then they were actually floating for those sequences, which is a pretty amazing production decision, rather dangerous perhaps, but it worked out. Mm. And, you know, it's a Ron Howard film, which means the emotional beats are quite often heavy-handed. That's sort of his stock in trade, but very effective, I think, at recreating a number of things, including the fact that at the time of Apollo 13, as you know, Bill mentioned earlier, the idea of space travel becoming routine, right? Part of the dramatic conflict at the center of Apollo 13 is that the public has become quite jaded by this point, right?
We're bored with it.
Yeah, once we've walked on the moon, who cares? I think the film dramatizes that and then dramatizes the idea that you know, we are going to come together as a nation, as a world, to make sure that we bring back these lost astronauts. And it, in that sense, the Martian is a direct descendant, including this idea of slingshotting around the moon. There's talk of slingshotting around the planet Earth. So it shares a lot of DNA.
Yeah. All right. We have a clip.
Yes, we do. So this is from early in the film and addresses these issues when Tom Hanks, unaware that he will become the commander. He's Jim Lovell, a real-life person, become the commander of Apollo 13. He's slated to be the commander of Apollo 14. But here he is giving a tour of NASA facilities with members of the press.
The astronaut is only the most visible member of a very large team, and all of us, right down to the guy sweeping the floor, are honored to be a part of it. What did the man say? Give me a lever long enough and I'll move the world? Well, that's exactly what we're doing here. This is divine inspiration, folks. It's the best part of each one of us, the belief that anything is possible. Things like a computer that can fit into a single room and hold millions of pieces of information. Or the Saturn V rocket. Now, this is the actual launch vehicle that will be taking Alan Shepard and his crew on the first leg of the Apollo 13 mission.
When are you going up again, Jim?
I'm slated to be the commander of Apollo 14 sometime late next year.
If there is an Apollo 14. Now, Jim, people in my state have been asking why we're continuing to fund this program now that we've beaten the Russians to the moon.
Yeah, this is one of the big issues, right? What does NASA do now without funding? And it's a very contemporary issue, which we were talking before about in The Martian, makes a good case. I think when you see this film, you'll see that it kind of reinvigorates this idea, our ideas of the space program.
And picking up from there, Interstellar, which it was a flawed movie in my opinion, nevertheless, I think does a good job, particularly in its first part, tackling these very issues. The idea that we've lost our ability to dream about using our scientific innovation to solve our problems. And so a crew is put together, headed by Matthew McConaughey, to travel through a wormhole to discover other planets for humans to inhabit. And here we have a clip with Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway discussing some really kind of interesting and scientifically legitimate ideas about what would happen in terms of bending of time and space if you got close to a black hole, which could potentially be something that we have to face in the future if we do engage in interstellar travel.
Miller's side has kept pinging thumbs up, as has Dr. Mann's. Edmonds went down 3 years ago.
Transmitter failure?
Maybe. He was sending the thumbs up right until it went dark.
But Miller still looks good, though, right? Because she's coming up fast.
Mm-hmm.
With one complication. The planet is much closer to Gargantua than we thought.
Gargantua.
It's what we're calling the black hole. Miller's and Dr. Mann's planets both orbit it.
And Miller's is on the horizon?
Oh, it's a basketball around a hoop. Landing there takes us dangerously close, and a black hole that big has a huge gravitational pull.
Look, I could swing around that neutron star to decelerate.
No, it's not that. It's time. The gravity on that planet will slow our clock compared to Earth's drastically.
Well, how bad?
Well, every hour we spend on that planet will be 7 years back on Earth.
Yeah, this is kind of like, you know, learning the video game rules before you play the game, right?
Yeah.
This 7 years for 1 hour. It's very starkly represented in the film. Another aspect of this is interesting is that they're actually going into space to try to figure out a way to rescue us, as opposed to being stranded, like off Apollo 13, being stranded and needing to get rescued.
The rest of civilization, you mean?
Yeah.
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 Chris, okay, then The Martian is the reason why we're having this show today.
Indeed, opens today in 3D, starring Matt Damon as Mark Watney, an astronaut stranded on the red planet because his crew thinks he's died. And the film cuts between his life now that he's been abandoned on Mars, people back on Earth thinking he's dead, then learning, you know, that he's not, and then the crew that abandoned him thinking he was dead on their spaceship return to Earth. So we've got these three different groups, and I think it's a very, you know, effective film. I think it's a lot of fun. I think dramatically there are perhaps a few moments that could have been more powerful, but it's very, very well done, and it uses these video logs that Matt Damon is keeping, and this is consistent with the book, which kind of serves as our exposition, because he's alone. So he has to talk to someone, and he chooses to talk to himself. And in this scene, he's explaining for the log how he's going to grow crops because he only has limited rations, and he's on a planet where there's no bacteria in the earth. But fortunately, NASA did send some potatoes with the crew. So he's going to plant them in this earth that he's going to cultivate as a super botanist.
Right. Let's do the math. Our service mission here was supposed to last 31 souls. For redundancy, they sent 68 souls worth of food. That's for six people. So for just me, that's going to last 300 souls, which I figure I can stretch to 400 if I ration. So I got to figure out a way to grow 3 years worth of food here on a planet where nothing grows. Luckily, I'm a botanist. Mars will come to fear my botany powers.
I like what I'm hearing there.
Yeah, this got a big laugh from the audience, and I think that's one of the things about this movie that makes it so effective is the way that Ridley Scott is able to manage tone shifts from dark, very dire circumstances to light, sort of insightful humor like this. It's very playful when it needs to be. It's very dangerous when it needs to be. It actually reminds me of one of his other movies, Thelma and Louise, of all things, because of the way he's got such dexterity moving between these tone shifts. It doesn't feel unnatural like you think it might.
Great. That's The Martian, which opens this weekend. Bill Uren, it's nice to have you on the show again with us. What is The Lady and the Tiger? This is a film you're working on.
Yeah, it is. It's very interesting because it's a Chinese-American production. So the film is in Chinese, and they've brought me in. I'm doing subtitles. I'm doing continuity. They're saying, does it track for an American audience? So it's been a lot of fun.
Good luck with that, Bill. Nice to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Bill Uren, who teaches screenwriting at Goucher College. And Christopher Llewellyn Reed, chair of the Department of Film and Video at Stevenson University. I want to say it's been a great pleasure doing these shows with you.
It has, Dan. It's been a great 3 years. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
You. And to Linda DeLibro, too, who couldn't be with us today, but it's been great having you do Midday on Films with us. We're going to take a break here on Midday Friday, and when we come back, some closing thoughts. And enjoy the music on the way out here. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, I've reached the end of my run here at WYPR. Today's show is my last as host. Starting Monday, Sheila Cast, for many years the host of Maryland Morning, will be taking my place in Studio A as host of Midday. During the last 7.5 years, I've held 2 jobs, this one and my longtime position as a columnist at the Baltimore Sun. I've decided to devote all my attention to my work at the newspaper and to serve you that way. I want to take this opportunity to extend sincere thanks to all of you who have supported this show with calls and letters, or just by listening. I certainly hope that I and the many guests I've interviewed over the years have served your lifelong love of learning, your intellectual curiosity, your interest in the affairs of Baltimore, Maryland, the nation, and the world. What a pleasurable adventure it has been for me to interview so many fascinating people, gifted writers of good and great books, public officials, experts in all facets of life. WYPR provided me with this great opportunity, and I am grateful for it. I'm grateful to the friends we made on Midday, who became regular guests, Sherry Parks, Rona Cabell, David Zurowick, Linda DeLibero and Chris Reed, John Shields and Henry Hong, Dr. John Smarr. I'm also thankful to the young producers, engineers, directors, and collegiate interns who made the show possible. The last several months have been particularly challenging, a crush of events and news here, and there certainly are more challenges ahead for Baltimore, my adopted hometown. So I'll be around. You've not heard the end of me. I am very grateful for all the opportunities I've had in broadcasting since arriving in the Queen City of the Patapsco Drainage Basin nearly 40 years ago to take a newspaper job. So, 2 radio shows and 1 TV show. And each time, I called upon Ella Fitzgerald for some wisdom and parting words. So I think we'll maintain that tradition today. Thanks again, everybody. Good health, good luck, and remember,
you got to accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In-Between. You got to spread joy up to the maximum, bring gloom down to the minimum, have faith or pandemonium liable to walk up on the scene. To illustrate my last remark, Jonah in the whale, Noah in the ark. What did they do just when everything looked so dark? Man, they said we better accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In Between. No, don't mess with Mr. In Between.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Adam Drumberg and Aaron Lorenzi. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.
With the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In Between. No!